We continue in this session with the three philosophers who are known as the continental rationalists, Descartes, Spinoza, and Leibniz. They all lived on the continent of Europe, so we're distinguishing them from the next three that we're going to look at, all of whom lived in Britain, and they are called the British empiricists. The difference between the two has to do with their view of the rational order that exists in the world and is known by the human mind and used by humans to reason and make theories and draw conclusions. The rationalists don't simply believe that there are laws of logic and mathematics. They believe that those are the very fabric of the universe. And Descartes even speaks of them as secondary substance, and I explained that term in previous lecture. Substance means what has independent existence. So you would think that any Christian philosophizing would say only God has independent existence. God is the reality that stands under, stance and sub, that stands under and supports, gives existence to everything else. And that's what Descartes did say. So he wasn't as extreme a rationalist as the two fellows that followed him. For Spinoza and Leibniz, however, there's more at stake. What has independent existence, and that includes logic and math, which they tend to see as pretty much the same thing. I think in our own time we distinguish them because they have been elaborated, especially logic has been developed so much in the 20th century that it's certainly not identical with math, though there is a point at which they converge. But it includes logic and math and a slogan that very nicely sums up their attitude about the rest of it. And it goes like this. The real is rational. And the rational is real. Think about that for a minute. See what they're trying to get away with here. Because the rules that we use to prove things, the laws of logic and mathematics, are regarded as having independent existence. They're part of substance, secondary substance. Remember, that's what Descartes called it? God's the primary substance, but we've got this other mediating substance. And for for Spinoza, for example, the mediating substances are mind and body. Mind is the reality that operates according to the logical and mathematical laws. Well, let's say minds are supposed to do that. I mean, I've had a few students that struggled with that one. But they think that that's what mind is, a rational thinking thing. And they regard this slogan as the key to reality in this strong sense. This means whatever is not self-contradictory is real. Whoa. Do they really mean that? They sure did. And you can see it most clearly in Spinoza's proofs of God's existence. Spinoza gave a number of proofs, and we'll look at them just now. But think about this. If the definition of a thing is not self-contradictory, then it's real. And then they proceed to show that the definition of God as the being with all and only perfections is not self-contradictory, therefore God exists. But I don't see any reason I can't say the same thing about a flying carpet. There's nothing in the concept of a flying carpet that's self-contradictory. But that doesn't make them real. Not being self-contradictory makes something possible, not actual. It's possible. And I think there are other reasons why flying carpets aren't possible. I don't think they pass that criterion. But there are all sorts of things, the definition of which doesn't contradict itself, which are not real and are never going to be. I think a talking tree runs close second to a flying carpet. There are all sorts of fantasy things that we can think of that don't contradict themselves. So they're not logically impossible, but they're physically impossible or biologically impossible or impossible in some other sense. They're not having it. The real is the rational, and the rational is the real. It was Einstein who made an interesting comment about that, about everything. Whenever math can be done, shown, whatever can be mathematicized, that is then therefore rational. So Einstein says one time, not everything that counts can be counted, and not everything that can be counted counts. Clever moose. Sure, not everything that can be expressed in math therefore counts is real. And not everything that's real can be reduced to a mathematical formula. So he rejects both sides of that rationalistic extreme. But our buddy Spinoza here affirms it. Let's have a look at a couple of the proofs that Spinoza offers. One of them goes like this. God alone is substance. Two, God has all and only perfections. A perfection, of course, is any property that makes something better to have it than lack it, and is possessed in the maximal degree, or the highest possible instance of it. So this is the view that God has the highest possible justice, love, mercy, knowledge, power, wisdom, grace, and so on. Whatever the perfections are, however many there are, and there may be a million that we don't know about, but God's the being that has all perfections and only perfections. So, premise three, God is, and this is by definition, uncaused and unpreventable. Therefore, God must exist. And the must there is a logical must. It means to deny that God exists, you have to contradict yourself. So that can't be right. In this way, this argument by Spinoza reflects one given earlier by Saint Anselm around 1100. Anselm came up with the same sort of thing. God's the being with all and only perfections, therefore God has perfect existence. What's perfect existence is over against imperfect. Well, if you have perfect existence, you are completely self-existent. Yeah. You are unconditionally non-dependent. And only God has that. You and I have existence, but it's not the perfect existence. We didn't always exist, and we will cease to, at least in this life. So we are not uncaused or unpreventable, but God is. That's what we mean by God. Therefore, and Psalm's going to say, it follows that God has to exist. And Spinoza repeats that. In another proof, he does this. 1. Assume God doesn't exist. 2. But God is defined as the being that cannot fail to exist. If God has all perfections, he has perfect existence. So that requires that he cannot fail. So what happens then in step 3 of the argument? These two premises contradict each other. But God can't be uncaused and unpreventable. And not exist. Therefore, God exists necessarily. Where necessarily means you have to contradict yourself to deny it. Both Anselm's argument and Spinoza's assume that. Since you have to contradict yourself to deny that God exists, God must exist. And of course, there's a famous criticism of this, and it is that it treats existence as though it's one more property of things. Ordinary things that we experience every day, this pen, have properties. This has the property of being white, has the property of being solid, has the property of being light enough to be lifted in one hand, has the property of making marks on them, on my electronic blackboard here. Is existence one more characteristic of it? And the objection says, no, existence is just whether there is such a thing as the pen. It's not one more property of the pen. There can't be a pen from which you can subtract existence. You can subtract all the other properties. This doesn't have to be white. It doesn't have to be solid. It doesn't have to be light enough to lift. We can make it, fix it, so it's all none of those things. We can subtract any of those properties and substitute other properties. It can be a different color, different size, different shape. And if we make it out of the proper material, it can be attracted to the table as a magnet so that you would have to exert 1,000 pounds to lift it. But if you take away existence, you take away the whole thing and its properties. It's not just another property of a thing, and you're treating it as though it is. I think the objection is exactly right. Well, Spinoza has other proofs, but they all come down to the same stuff. And they all assume that the real is rational. That means whatever is real is capable of having a rational explanation, definition. It's open to human knowledge. It's open to being conceived logically. And whatever works out logically is rational. Whatever can be defined rationally, whatever is subject to proof, and we can construct the proof in front of you and so on, then if it's rational, it's real. And of course, that's the part that they are trying to apply to God. They're saying it's rational. We can give a rational definition. God's the being with all and only perfections. Now, there are two other courses in which I've criticized that argument, that idea of God. And I don't want to repeat all of that here, but I'm going to give an abbreviated account of it. And start with this. Scripture doesn't mention anything about perfections. It attributes different characteristics to God. And I think it does so because God really has those characteristics. It says that God knows us, that He created and sustains the whole of creation, including us, that it grieves God that we are sinful creatures that do not live in accordance with His law. And God has created a plan of salvation and in fact come into His own world as a human to rescue us from the consequences of our own sin. All those things are in Scripture, and that gives us God's plan of salvation. It does not, however, say God is all and only perfections. It doesn't mention any perfection. In fact, the only time I know of that the word perfection occurs in the New Testament is when Jesus says to His disciples, "You be perfect as your Father in heaven is perfect." Now, according to the view that God is the being with all and only perfections, this statement would be telling, in this statement, Jesus would be telling His disciples something absolutely crazy. He'd be telling them to be God. You be perfect as your Father is perfect. And that's not at all what it means. It has nothing to do with Plato's idea that there are perfections in another realm. When St. Augustine read that, he said, Plato discovered God. There's the highest perfection of all. And Plato even calls it the God and Father of all things. See, that's the way to understand our God revealed in Scripture. And my reaction to that is utter horror. No, it's not. You don't take a pagan theory and stick it into try to impose it on Scripture and read Scripture through the lenses of the pagan theory. Augustine thought that Plato was wrong only because Plato thought that there were a myriad of perfections. He didn't understand that they're all combined in one being. In other words, for Augustine, God doesn't have the perfections, He is them. But then if Jesus says to His disciples, "You be perfect as your Father in heaven is perfect," He's telling them to be divine beings. He's telling them to be self-existent creators of the universe, which is nuts. Okay, what does it mean? The Greek meaning of perfect is the highest possible degree of something, the maximal instance of goodness, justice, knowledge, power, and so on. Those are all perfections. But Jews didn't use the term that way. To them, perfect, when they used it, meant complete. And what Jesus is talking about here is the covenant between God and human beings. He says to His disciples, "You be completely faithful to your end of the covenant as God in heaven is to His end of the covenant." It's got nothing to do with God being comprised of perfection. So I find that theory of Plato's is not only not supported philosophically. You can say, here's a theory, but you can't give convincing reasons to show it's right. But it's incompatible with what Scripture does say about God and the properties attributes that he has. One entire chapter of Scripture is devoted to the fact that God's wisdom is something he created. Proverbs 8, wisdom says of herself, I was the first of God's creatures. He brought me forth before the heavens and earth. So prior to creating any of the rest of the universe, God brought it about. There's such a thing as wisdom, and he possesses it. That doesn't mean that there was ever a time God didn't have it, because God exists outside time. He created time as a feature of his creation, created cosmos. But it does mean that it depends on him to be. The fact that there is such a quality and that anything can have it, including God, is something God has brought about. And that chapter ends with wisdom saying of herself, and after he used me as a guide in all creation, then I was with the children of men. So God sees to it that human beings are created so that they too can participate in wisdom, and they don't have to be fools all the time. I find that what Scripture does say about God and the way he possesses his properties then is utterly at odds with this theory of perfections. So I wouldn't define God that way to begin with. God's not the being of all that who has or is all and only perfections. God is the being who has created everything other than himself. And since the New Testament says that means everything visible and invisible, it covers everything, which is why St. Basil, the 4th century theologian, put it this way. If there are perfections, God created them. He's not sure there are. He's not totally convinced that Plato is right, as Augustine became some years after St. Basil. But Basil knows enough to say, whatever is real is created. Everything that's real other than God is created by God. And Colossians 1 says that means everything visible or invisible. That covers the lot. So I have serious disagreements with the work that Spinoza is doing here. I don't think that the real is totally rational, and I certainly don't think that whatever turns out not to be self-contradictory has to be real. That seems to me beyond the pale. Seems to me silly, and I don't know why a really intelligent person would say a thing like that. Just because the definition of something doesn't contradict itself doesn't mean, poof, it exists. No. And I gave you some examples already. Well, I won't belabor this point. Spinoza gave other proofs. They are all basically alike. God is defined as the being with all perfections. Perfect existence means that he cannot come into being or pass away. Therefore, God is the being that cannot come into being and can't pass away. Therefore, God exists. And you go, whoa, wait a minute, something went wrong there. And the something is that he's assuming if it doesn't contradict itself, it's real. And certainly there are a myriad of things that we can define so that the definition does not contradict itself. But they're not real and never have been and never will be. Well, I think that's going to do it for our recap of Mr. Spinoza. The next person that we covered briefly and need to recap also is Leibniz. You'll find that sometimes his name is spelled T with a TZ, sometimes just Z. The proper way it would have been written in German is just with the Z. And Leibniz also thinks the real is rational, the rational is real. I mentioned to you what a towering genius this fellow was, but he still buys into the rationalistic assumption that the rational is real and the real is rational. Now, these two fellows are confronted with Descartes' work. They read Descartes, and they want to affirm the dualism that Descartes held. There's minds and bodies, and in humans they're not the same thing, and they're completely distinct by definition. Spinoza gets over the interaction problem. How then could they interact by being a pantheist? Well, at root, they're both the same. They're made out of the being of God. So the interaction takes place in the being of God, so we can't explore it further. But then, as things manifest themselves to our experience, they come across as mind or body. That's our experience. But behind our experience, behind the scenes, it's all part and parcel of God, of the being of God. Leibniz can't go along with that. Leibniz is not a pantheist. He doesn't want to be one anyway. He wants to affirm God, God is taught in the Christian religion. Leibniz was a Christian. But he needs to overcome the interaction problem. How's he going to do that? Well, in his ontology, he proposes that all things consist of what he calls monads. What the heck is a monad? It's just a way of saying a unit. There are basic units of reality. And what are these basic units? They are centers of force, physical force, and consciousness. And all creatures are comprised of monads. Now, you understand what he's telling you? The tiniest particles of matter aren't just force, but they're also conscious. Everything has some mind in it, because all monads do. And when you put something together that's many of these tiny units, and you get a bigger thing, you get more mind. So you get more consciousness. So there never is a reality that's solely physical, and then the biological emerges. And then from the biological emerges consciousness, perception, for example. And then from that emerges rationality. No, for Leibniz, it's all there in the beginning. It all starts with units that are units of force, that's their material side, their physical side, and units of consciousness combined. And you get varying degrees of matter, you get more intense matter, more solid stuff, the higher up the scale you go in the level of creatures that exist. The higher up you go means the more units that are put together, the more monads it takes to constitute this. So presumably it takes more to constitute a dog than it does to constitute a daisy. Daisies are conscious, they have consciousness. But it doesn't rise to the point of being able to perceive other things, have perceptions or concepts. I don't know whether Leibniz thought animals had concepts. We now know that higher animals do. Dolphins, for example, chimpanzees, gorillas, they've been taught the deaf sign language and they communicate with their trainers, stuff like that. So this stuff might emerge gradually. I think both Spinoza and Leibniz would applaud Darwin's theory that this stuff developed gradually. Because they just say that shows that God planted the seeds of the development right in the original stuff, which he called into being and made creation. And then it worked its way up. They'd have no problem with that at all. But the monads, this is weird, right? The dust at your feet is conscious. Only very dimly conscious. But I wonder if it knows it's being stepped on. Maybe not. That's too high a concept. But then by the time you get to a human being, the human is both physical and mental, right? That means consciousness. But for humans, mental means not only consciousness, it's conscious, but is rational, knows the laws of logic and especially mathematics, and is able to understand the creation around him and other humans because of the ability to form logical concepts, do mathematical proofs, and so on. These are, in Leibniz's own terms, substance. It's not that minds are substance, but the laws of consciousness and rationality are, and minds are those powers of the human self, able to grasp them, reason according to them, use them to calculate and understand the world around them. That and force. So whereas Descartes defined the material side as occupying space, that was supposed to be the main characteristic of physics, Leibniz says no, it's to be a point of force. And that's much closer to what Newton is going to do. So, we have a different sort of theory. Very different. Well, how does this explain interaction? When you think about what Spinoza said, he actually denies interaction. Descartes says there's real interaction between mind and body. And I don't know how it works. It's a miracle caused by God. I can't see any way to explain it. Spinoza says there really is no interaction between mind and body. The interaction takes place where mind and body converge in the being of God. So they're just the same thing in God. They're not different. So one can do something and produce effects in another because they're all made out of the being of God. That's what transmits this. So they're not really two utterly different things affecting one another, producing effects in the other. That's what we experience. From our point of view, we don't see the divine being. We see minds and bodies. But since it's all made of the divine being, that's pantheism, it's all made of the divine being, the what would be interaction, the one affecting the other takes place in the being of God behind the scenes. When we come to Leibniz, Leibniz doesn't want to be a pantheist. He wants to say God created these monads, the force units of force and consciousness, and they do not, the consciousness does not produce effects in the force, and the force does not produce effects in the consciousness. He's got a dualism in which mind and body interaction looks impossible to explain again. But instead of saying it, just saying there is no interaction, he tells you why we experience things as though there is. And his theory goes like this. In each monad, and this is a human monad we're talking about, okay, there's a mental side, and there's a body. There's mind and body. All right, there are all these points of force and matter up here in the mental side. We have percepts, and concepts. And the body never produces an effect in the mind, nor the mind in the body. But it doesn't need to, because we'd experience the world the way we do, even if they didn't actually produce effects in the other, provided that God pre-programmed each to reflect the other. So his theory is that God pre-programmed the mind so that every time, let's say, the body stubs its toe, pain occurs in the mind. And it is pain in that toe that was stubbed. And every time the mental decides to move, I decide to move my foot, the body, that is the foot, responds. The body moves the way I want it to move. And God has pre-programmed each of these, each human monad, so that its entire life, it never is in contact with any other monad. It's never in contact with anything outside itself. But the expression has been, according to his theory, monads are windowless. They have no windows. Nobody peeks out and sees what's going on in the world. Why? Well, because it's like having a TV camera. You've been pre-programmed. Here is all that's going on in the world running off inside your mind as though it's percepts of what's outside, when it's been pre-programmed, because God's pre-programmed the whole thing. All that's ever going to happen physically, all that's ever going to happen mentally. Everybody has willed to move their body in a certain way. He's pre-programmed the body to move that way at that time. A little far-fetched, and it has a big drawback. If God has pre-programmed what takes place in our minds and affects our bodies, and what takes place in our bodies and affects our minds, what happens to our freedom? Why isn't it the case then that we have no free will? It looks as though there isn't any way to squeeze the freedom in. Leibniz wanted it in. He wanted to affirm free will. But his system doesn't seem to allow it. And I remind you again about this debate between determinism and freedom. Determinism is the view that we, all of our actions, thoughts, beliefs, attitudes, feelings are determined, that is, absolutely caused to be by physical forces that existed before we existed and which impact us so that we are not actually free. We think we are, but all that we like, dislike, believe, not believe, all that we perceive is produced in us, and it does not need the cooperation of our will to do it. So when we talk about human freedom, it narrows the issue too strictly to just talk about freedom of the will. That only talks about choices that we make. And it's important for ethics and the law, for example, to say that somebody did an action of his own free will, therefore he's responsible for it. The determinist wants to say all of our actions, and our means all humans, are determined by forces that existed before we ever were born. And those forces impact us so that it makes us think what we think, believe what we believe, dislike what we dislike, and so on. But talking about it as free will seems to narrow it just to the choices that we make. We need freedom not only of the will, but freedom to think rationally, to weigh evidence, to draw conclusions. A lot of determinists concede that there's no free will, and they say, therefore, our justice system should be different. I mentioned this last lecture. They say that of someone who killed somebody else, murdered someone else, should be segregated from the rest of society. They should be locked up if they did it, so that they won't kill anymore. They can't get to any more. Of course, you might think no murder was ever committed in prison. But they should not be blamed. We can't say this is an awful person just because they like to kill people and eat their victims or something, like Jeffrey Dahmer. Wow, it's not evil, it's just he didn't come out well given the forces that went into forming our galaxy and our planet and finally his body and so on. He couldn't help being that way. But I'm saying it's not just freedom of the will, but freedom of reason. If you've kissed off freedom, you also can't reason freely. And that means that all our trouble of investigating something, say scientifically, to find out what constitutes it and how it works, all of our trouble, all of our evidence gathering, and then evidence weighing, and then deciding between competing theories, and coming to a reasonable conclusion, that's all illusion too. We're forced to every one of the conclusions we accept all along the way. That's what determinism entails. Not just no freedom of choice for ethics and the law, but no freedom of reasoning over the entire spectrum of human experience. And having taken that away, the theory also then defeats itself. If we have no freedom to reason and come to a reasonably drawn conclusion and believe it for the reasons, then we have no reason to think that determinism is exempt from that. It too is forced on the people that believe it, and it's not the result of a rational argument or evidence. So determinism is self-defeating, and I think that's the main reason that, and the fact that we have the experience of choosing freely and rational deliberation that agonizes over coming to the right conclusion finally does. Maybe a member of a jury or something, and here's all the evidence for and against the guilt of this person, weighs it, summarizes the arguments, goes through them, finds flaws, finds points that the two attorneys didn't make, thinks of the whole thing through and comes to a conclusion in voting for the guilt or innocence of the poor sap on trial. So don't be too quick to be impressed by the determinist arguments, because if he's right, he doesn't believe it for those arguments. He believes it because of the way the Big Bang took place 13 billion years ago. That's his own theory. I think Leibniz has a serious problem trying to keep freedom if whatever occurs on this side produces effects here only because God pre-programmed this to respond that way, and whatever occurs here is perceived and weighed and judged here because God pre-programmed this to take place at just this time, and there's no real interaction at all. So that's how the problem of interaction was confronted in Descartes' own century, in the 17th century. So we have three positions. Real interaction, but I know not how, that's Descartes. The illusion of interaction not needed because mind and body at bottom are one. That's Spinoza. And Leibniz, there's no real interaction, but there's a pre-established harmony between mind and body because God's pre-programmed both to reflect what's going on in the other. Wild stuff, huh? Yeah. I see where we've run out of time. I think this little review would be helpful, though, especially if you're reading Descartes and Spinoza and Leibniz. I hope you are keeping up with that reading. And we will next time proceed to go further in this century, and we'll look at what takes place now in Britain with the philosophers who are called British empiricists. And let's get that word clear right from the beginning here. An empiricist is someone who believes that experience is how we come to know the world around us and ourselves, and the chief example of that is sense perception. In fact, this group of philosophers who emphasize getting your information from experience, meaning sense perception, go so far with this. Let me start that again. They carry it to an extreme in that they don't really start with our experience. I agree with empiricism if it means that experience is the source of our knowledge of ourselves, of other people, and the world around us. But what is it that we experience? And they say the first thing that occurs to consciousness, the first thing that we experience, are perceptions. And they believe that perceptions are separate things that exist inside minds. And they are things that have only one kind of properties. And that's what's given to us in our experience. So they all start off by saying the given are these things called sensory data or sense perceptions. They are sights, tastes, touches, sounds, and smells that register in our minds. And they only have the properties of colors, tastes, touches, sounds, and smells. Ladies and gentlemen, that's not what we find in our experience. The primary thing that occurs in our experience is the experience of things, events, states of affairs. Relations. Persons. In other words, they want to start with experience, and they claim that what's immediately given to our experience, not created by us, just comes to us, depending on what we touch, where we look, what we listen for, and so on, are sensory perceptions that are supposed to be copies of the things that caused them. That's not what's given to our experience. You don't experience a sense datum when you reflect on your experience. Your experience right now is of things and events and states of affairs. And these things, as we experience them, have exhibit many kinds of properties. They have many kinds of properties. Here's what I mean. You experience, say, your living room. You look around, you see tables, a table maybe. At chairs, maybe a sofa, a painting hanging on the wall. You see a window on one wall. You don't see touches, tastes, sounds, and smells. You see objects which have a multiplicity of kinds of properties, including colors, sounds, tastes, touches, and smells. But the things that you experience also have physical properties. They have wet mass and weight, they're solid, so on. They also have mathematical properties. You can measure them, there's a how much to them. If you need to replace the curtains at the window, you can go measure the window and you'll know what size curtain you need. There's a how much to both. Right? There are logical properties to all these things. I know that'll sound funny to some of my viewers. Logical properties? The only things that have logical properties, most people think, are statements or arguments. Arguments can be valid or invalid. A statement can be true or false. It can be consistent or inconsistent with another statement. But can things have logical properties? Of course they can. They can have the property of being able to be logically distinguished, able to be logically conceived. If they didn't have those properties, they couldn't be logically conceived and distinguished. Things have linguistic properties. What does that mean? Things don't all talk. No, that's right. Humans have the power of speech. Humans are active linguistically, but objects around us are passive linguistically. We can name them. We can number them. They can enter into our discussion by using their name. Able to be referred to in language as a linguistic property. So I'm saying what is given to us in experience are things, events, states of affairs, relationships, people, all sorts of stuff like that. And all of them exhibit a multiplicity of kinds of properties. They exhibit properties that are quantitative, mathematical. They exhibit properties that are spatial, size, shape, and location. They exhibit properties that are of change and movement. They're kinematic properties. They exhibit physical properties, mass, weight, solidity, density. They exhibit very often, and they have sensory properties as well. They exhibit some color, some sounds made, taste, touch, smell. Yes, those are one among many kinds of properties they have. But these two poor guys, in wanting to start with what we experience, limit themselves to perceptions that they think of as having only the sensory kind of properties. And all of the empiricists that we're going to look at make that mistake right at the outset. What's given in our experience are sensory perceptions that have only properties of color, sound, taste, touch, smell. So when they go to give an account of the whole of experience, they find that they can't find their way from the sensory properties to any other kind. And they end up, every one of them, with the view that all that we know is inside our heads. Because what we know are sense perceptions. But then what we can't know is whether those perceptions copy a real world outside of us, or whether there is a real world outside of us. That's all you have to know about this group of people to know that it's laughable that often Christians are challenged and told that their faith isn't in the same category with, say, the philosophy of the Enlightenment. The Enlightenment was what did away with all the superstitions. And the Enlightenment freed reason and gave it free realm to roam over the whole of human experience and explain it, and we don't need to believe in God to do that. And what they fail to mention is the Enlightenment thinkers left to us a legacy of not knowing whether there's a world around us at all, or if there is, what it's like. The legacy they left us is that we're locked inside our own minds. All we know are the perceptions that we have in here, inside our brains or our minds. And we don't know the so-called external world, the world outside of us, or whether there is one. In fact, nobody knows whether or not he or she is the only thing that exists. And is having these internal virtual reality shows reeled off in its mind when there's nothing else. That's a pretty sad legacy. And if you think that those the theories that conclude that way are crazy, I agree with you. Next time we'll begin them.